Actually, the first time it rang, I just sort of stood there and said, you know, this has got to just be an errant call. They'll just go away. So it stopped ringing. I went back in the bedroom and then it started ringing again. Now I was really getting mad. And so I sort of went out there and grabbed the phone, and I guess it's still dark. So I guess I pushed the answer button instead of the hang up button. And, you know, there was this fellow on the phone with a Swedish accent, you know, sort of informing me of this, which, you know, there's no way I was expecting this to happen. So I really didn't believe him. At first, I thought maybe it was a ill-advised practical joke by people in the lab. He continued telling me that this was real. And then when he mentioned, you know, sort of Harvey Alter and Michael Houghton and hepatitis C, then it sort of, you know, started to make maybe it sounded a little bit more real.
You're listening to Masterminds, where we sit down with experts in science and medicine to talk about everything from the research of today to the innovation of tomorrow. This is Will.
And this is Mishka. And today we sat down with Dr. Charles Rice, the Maurice R. and Corinne P. Greenberg Professor in Virology at Rockefeller University. Dr. Rice is an expert in RNA viruses, viruses that use RNA as opposed to DNA in their genome, and studies the body's innate immune responses to infection. However, he's most known for his work on hepatitis C virus, which causes liver disease and cirrhosis if untreated.
Dr. Rice was the first to achieve a successful cell culture of hepatitis C, create a functional clone of the virus, and prove that the virus causes the disease. This work led to the first effective treatments for hepatitis C, saving millions of lives worldwide and earning Dr. Rice and his collaborators the 2020 Nobel Prize in Medicine or Physiology. We hope you enjoy this episode with Dr. Charles Rice.
And how did you end up studying and getting interested in studying virology?
Well, that was just, you know, kind of a random chance event. In terms of the undergraduate research that I did at UC Davis, it was more focused on developmental biology. And an instructor who turned out to be a mentor for me, sort of Dennis Barrett, taught an introductory biology course. And that really, he was a great, great teacher. And that really got me, you know, sort of motivated, I think, towards biology. And then I actually worked with him on sea urchin development, where you can, you know, basically harvest the eggs and the sperm, mix them together in seawater, and, you know, watch fertilization happen and development unfold. So when I was deciding, you know, sort of what to do after UC Davis, the experiences that I'd had at Davis, but also at the Marine Biology Laboratory in Woods Hole, where I spent a summer between my junior and senior year, sort of solidified an interest in doing research. And unlike sort of what you guys do when you apply to, you know, sort of 30 schools for PhD programs or MDs or MD programs or MD PhD programs, I applied to two PhD programs, Caltech, where my sort of UC Davis mentor had been a graduate student, and UC San Diego. I grew up in Northern California. And so these were sort of Southern California destinations, which was, you know, sort of kind of a traitorous move for a Northern Californian to consider going south. But anyway, when I arrived at Caltech, one of the reasons that I applied there was that there was a lab headed by Eric Davidson, who was, you know, sort of one of the famous sea urchin developmental biologists. And San Diego also had some things that were, you know, developmental biology oriented. And so when I arrived at Caltech, in the fall of 1975, a long time ago, I was placed in a virology lab, not in the sea urchin development lab. So in those days, in our PhD program, the students have to do three rotations before they decide on the lab that they're going to, you know, do their thesis research. And at Caltech, at least at that time, you could, you know, sort of try out different labs, but I think the expectation was that you get placed in a lab and chances are you might, you know, sort of stay there and pursue your thesis. And I really enjoyed my experience, sort of working on viruses in the Strauss lab at Caltech. So it was really just, sort of random chance that I started working on virology. It wasn't something that, oh, viruses are cool, this is what I want to do. It was more like, oh, I'm in a lab, that studies viruses. These guys are pretty interesting.
So how did you end up eventually at Washington University?
Yeah, so how did somebody that had this West Coast bias sort of end up in St. Louis at Washington University? Well, it turned out that at Caltech I started working with another he was ahead of me, so he sort of when I was doing my PhD he was already a postdoc, and his name was Henry Huang, and we started, doing some work on really trying to modernize how we studied sort of RNA viruses, and we were really having sort of a wonderful sort of collaborative engagement on that topic, and he started looking at jobs, and it turned out that at Washington University there was a lab headed by Sandra and Milton Schlesinger that worked on Synbis virus, which was the first RNA virus that sort of I worked on in the Strauss lab. And I had gotten to know them just by the fact that we were, sort of in the virology field working on the same virus. And Henry ended up taking a position at Washington University. So there was sort of Henry there and then the Schlesinger lab. And so there was kind of a core group of sort of similar, sort of interests and objectives there. So it was very attractive. I was really just having a great time, sort of doing lab work and doing science. And I was really just sort of looking for a position where I could, basically sneak in there and just sort of continue, sort of what I was doing without, undue delay. And so I only applied to a few places. I think Purdue was actually one of them. And then, since I like the outdoors, I applied to a place in Wyoming where, there were mountains nearby. So anyway, that's how I ended up at WashU. I mean, I had a brief sabbatical in Australia, and then I sort of left Australia, went to Pasadena, packed up the car, and drove out to Washington University after only having spent a day or two there. And yeah, it was definitely a culture shock, both in terms of culture and sort of composition of the people in the city, but also the weather was a bit of a shocker for somebody that grew up in Central Valley, California. I remember coming out of the a lab at like 1 o'clock in the morning, and finding that my car was now encased in an inch of frozen rain, and it took me like an hour and a half to chisel my way into it and turn on the engine and heat it up so that I could get these sheets of ice off the car and drive very carefully home on a Forest Parkway that was black ice. But I love St. Louis. I mean, I thought it was an easy place to live. I mean, obviously there wasn't, I don't know if there is now, but I mean, there wasn't great mass transportation. So I mean, you really did need a car. But the school was fantastic in terms of its support for fundamental research, and that was true of both. I was at the medical school, and that was certainly true in both the preclinical departments as well as the clinical departments. And it's still a powerhouse. I mean, I think it's one of the venues that is only getting more well known and just churning out great science.
So before you started studying hepatitis C virus, as I understand it, your studies into yellow fever virus predated that. Can you talk a little bit about what is yellow fever virus and what are the symptoms?
Yeah, sure. Well, so yellow fever virus is what we call an arbovirus. That means it's transmitted by arthropods, so arthropod-borne virus, arbovirus. And it is sort of the prototype memory of a member of a family that, you probably have heard about Zika and, sort of West Nile. It was sort of discovered by, sort of Walter Reed in 1900, and shown in that time to be mosquito transmissible. People didn't really sort of understand what viruses even were, except that, they were smaller than bacteria, and so they would pass through a filter that would trap, sort of larger bacteria. And the other thing that was amazing about sort of yellow fever, besides all of the trouble that it caused, and it's still causing, in areas in Africa and South America, was that, it was the first one of these viruses that really started getting studied in the laboratory. And there was an isolate in 1927 from a young Ghanaian called Acebe that was basically the prototype, sort of virus that people began working with in the lab. And that could be transmitted to rhesus macaques and eventually shown that it could actually infect and kill mice, which then sort of led to assays for looking at neutralizing antibodies in them. But the really exciting breakthrough in yellow fever research was by Max Tyler in 1937, where he had taken this Acebe virus that was virulent in macaques and passaged it in basically chopped up embryo tissue. There weren't the sort of cell culture models and so on that we have today for studying virus in those days. And the only way to sort of maintain a virus, since we didn't have freezers and things like that, was to actually passage it in animals. And anyway, Max had passaged this virus in chicken embryo tissue and mouse embryo tissue over 100 times, and isolated a variant of the virus that when it was used to infect a macaque, it was not virulent, it didn't cause disease. And then you could actually challenge that animal with the virulent parental virus and they were protected. And this vaccine, this then became a live attenuated virus vaccine that's now been in more than a half a billion people. And, but when I started working on it in the Strauss lab at Caltech, there wasn't really a lot known about the sort of molecular, virology. We didn't know, I mean, we knew that it was an RNA virus, not a DNA virus. But we didn't know the sequence of the genome. We didn't have ways of manipulating the genome to understand more about its how it replicated and what its functions were. And so, it seemed like, if we were going to tackle a member of this virus family that was quite widespread in terms of viruses that cause disease like yellow fever, that working with the vaccine strain was great, right? Because we could actually work with this in the laboratory. And this was the same virus that we were getting, basically immunized with. So, it wasn't like it was a terribly sort of virulent virus that we had to be, super careful and high containment in order to work with. So that was sort of one of the reasons that we began working on yellow fever. It eventually turned out to be sort of the prototype member of this new virus family, the flaviviridae. It was originally sort of lumped together with other envelope viruses like Synvis virus and a family called the togaviridae. So they basically had like a toga. And that was sort of a term to capture the idea that these things were viruses that had a lipid bilayer envelope that you could actually visualize by electron microscopy. So anyway, that's why we started working on yellow fever. And that's actually, I sort of continued that work during my sort of mini sabbatical in Australia, and then also continued working on that when I started my lab at Washington University.
And can you talk about some of the similarities and differences between yellow fever virus and hepatitis C virus?
Yeah, well, they're very different. And there are some people that would argue that, maybe they, don't belong, really in the same family. I have to say that, sort of virus classification is kind of at a turning point. It's always been, kind of a battle between the lumpers and the splitters in terms of, sort of how things are classified. And it's become even more confusing with the ability to, basically do a very sort of deep dive into the actual diversity of viruses that exist out there in the world, which we call the virome. One of the things that is similar, well, let me first do the differences. Okay, first of all, as I mentioned before, yellow fever is transmitted by insects, by mosquitoes, a species of mosquito called Aedes aegypti. And it caused widespread and sort of epidemics on the East Coast, you know, up as far north as Boston. And so it's, you know, it's a mosquito transmitted virus. Hepatitis C is not. I mean, it's also, you know, sort of a bloodborne virus, but it was identified in the context of giving people blood transfusions and then noticing that they came down with a disease that caused liver malfunction. So viral hepatitis. And I mean, yellow fever also attacks the liver. But, you know, the transmission route of these viruses is very, very different. So one being transmitted by mosquitoes, the other one, you know, sort of by blood products, which fortunately now after the discovery of the virus are safe, whereas they weren't before. And then there are also some differences in terms of the sequence and structure of the genome RNA. I don't know how much your, you know, sort of listeners know about, you know, RNA and DNA, probably quite a bit these days. But, you know, both of these viruses have RNA molecules as their genetic, you know, sort of makeup. And so when they enter a cell, that has to be replicated to, you know, make more sort of copies of that genome through an intermediate, which is a complementary sort of RNA to the genome RNA. And these are positive strand viruses, which means that if you extract that genome RNA from the particle and you introduce it into a permissive cell, so you take away the normal entry route that the virus would take by, you know, binding to a receptor and fusing the sort of viral envelope with a cellular membrane and delivering the genome to the cytoplasm of a susceptible cell. But if you bypass that just with naked genome RNA, these RNAs basically have all the information needed in order to launch replication. So they function as a messenger RNA to translate all of the viral proteins that are necessary for amplification. So that's true of both hepatitis C and also sort of yellow fever. There are some differences in terms of how they are translated. They're sort of a similar sort of gene order. And I guess one of the striking features of both of the viral genomes is that all of the viral proteins, with, you know, maybe some exceptions, are translated from one long polypeptide. So it's not like it has like separate RNAs that make the 10 different, you know, sort of mature proteins that the virus needs to replicate itself and make particles and so on. It's just sort of one long translation product, which then gets chopped up by cellular and viral enzymes, proteases, that sort of cleave these into the mature forms. So it's sort of this single long open reading frame. So those are some of the sort of similar features. And, you know, the reason that we started working on hepatitis C in 1989 was that, you know, it was clearly, in terms of the genome organization and so on, very similar to yellow fever. So it's kind of like we had a new member of the family that was just kind of dropped into, you know, our space with the sort of discovery of hepatitis C, which what it turned out to be, you know, the history of that is really fascinating. And the other Nobel laureates, you know, sort of played a huge role in that. And I mean, as I mentioned, it sort of came to the awareness of clinicians based on transfusions of blood products, you know, where the recipients then had evidence of chronic liver damage going on. And at that time, it became possible to determine if this was due to known viruses that cause, you know, hepatitis. And that would be, you know, hepatitis B virus, a small DNA virus, or hepatitis A virus. And it was shown that these cases of post-transfusion hepatitis were not due to hepatitis A or hepatitis B. So there must be something else that was responsible, and Harvey Alter basically called it non-A, non-B hepatitis. But it wasn't really known if there was one agent or a bunch of these agents. Harvey and his collaborators at the NIH and elsewhere, you know, sort of collected samples from these individuals that sort of came down with this disease. And this was all happening in the mid-1970s. And that basically launched an incredible effort by many, many labs sort of around the world to identify what this agent was. Now, today, you guys could just sort of extract nucleic acid from these samples and do deep sequencing, and you'd know in a week, you know, sort of what the you know, the agent might be. I mean, it would still be more work to actually prove it as opposed to say that there's an association. And so anyway, from the mid to late 1970s to 1989, there was a lot of effort, you know, trying to identify the agent. And it was really sort of Michael Houghton and his group working with Harvey and these sort of coded samples that eventually made a cDNA clone, sort of a small piece of the hepatitis C virus genome that reacted with serum from a patient that had sort of resolved non-A, non-B hepatitis. So it was sort of an immunostaining kind of screen that had just been invented by a group at Stanford at about that time. So, you know, it was almost 15 years of hard work, you know, sort of from the time that we knew something was going on to sort of the discovery of this. And when that happened, it was clear, you know, from fleshing out the genome sequence of hepatitis C that it was most similar to this, you know, the flaviviridae family, of which yellow fever was the prototype. So we were fortunate in the sense that we'd been sort of working on yellow fever at Washington University. So we had to make a decision as to whether or not we were going to start working on this sort of new agent. And it became quite clear shortly after the discovery of HCV that this was, you know, a very widespread infection affecting tens of millions of people. It was also clear at that time that it caused progressive and serious liver disease, and including liver cancer. So we decided to start working on it. And I think part of the push there came from an investigator who was at the Federal Drug Administration, the FDA, Stephen Finestone. And Steve called me up. I hadn't met him before, but he'd been involved in hepatitis virus discovery sort of at the NIH for a long time. And he was now in his independent lab and was really sort of focused on developing vaccines to protect people from these infections. And we had, after suffering for a number of years, we had finally actually figured out a way to manipulate the yellow fever genome. So we had made a functional molecular clone. I mean, these RNA viruses I mentioned, you know, they have RNA as their genome material. But if you want to be able to study that and introduce sort of mutations and see how they affect virus replication, we don't have at least at that time, we don't have a huge collection of tools for manipulating RNA. So what virologists would do is they would actually sort of force this RNA through a cDNA intermediate. So you could actually copy it with reverse transcriptase, put it in a plasmid, sort of propagate it. And then you could arrange that sort of plasmid copy of the viral genome to be a template to basically transcribe and make RNAs in a test tube, because the enzymes for doing that and the promoters that would allow site-specific initiation had been identified. And so we could essentially make, you know, unlimited quantities of RNA that basically mimicked a viral genome. And then if you had a permissive cell and you had a way of getting that RNA into the cell, which is sometimes just done by transiently disrupting the membrane of that, then you could actually initiate replication. You could make mutations on the DNA. Those would then be in the transcribed RNA, and then you could test their phenotype by transfecting them into the cell. So we had just done that for yellow fever, and it was difficult to do because it turned out that that the cdna clones of flaviviruses like yellow fever are very difficult to propagate in bacteria, which is where we amplify these plasmid dnas. At any rate, Steve saw this, and you know, he basically now had a way of manipulating the genome of this vaccine strain that had been in 500, you know, sort of million people. And the thought was that, well, maybe we could put in sequences from HCV, hepatitis C virus, into that yellow fever 17D sort of backbone, and then come up with a recombinant virus that would perhaps also immunize people against hepatitis C, and maybe would work. I mean, the great thing about the yellow fever vaccine is that it's one shot, and it appears to be lifelong protection with very few side effects. I mean, there are a few that are, you know, very, very rare, but it's really kind of the, you know, what we would like to have in a vaccine. I mean, you've seen this with COVID-19, you know, in order to sort of keep up protection and, you know, sort of outrun the sort of variation that pops up in the virus, we need, you know, sort of more than one vaccine to at least protect us from severe disease, because the virus is good at sort of reinfecting vaccinees or variants of the virus. So anyway, that's what really sort of pushed us to begin working on hepatitis C, because we really just didn't know much about how the proteins were actually made. I mean, we knew the overall genome structure. And then I guess our priority at that point really became, you know, can we set up systems in the laboratory that would allow us to study hepatitis C the way that we could study other RNA viruses like yellow fever? And, you know, I always sort of say that I think my virology career has been sort of a series of downward spirals in terms of, you know, sort of working on viruses that are harder and harder to actually work on. Syndesmosis virus, an alpha virus, you know, grows like a weed in the laboratory. So it's a joy to work with, because you can do experiments and you can find out the results quickly. Yellow fever is a little bit more finicky, but still, you know, we have nice cell culture systems that we can infect and animal models and so on. Hepatitis C, no way. I mean, this virus, people had been trying to culture non-A, non-B hepatitis in everything that they could think of. And the only model that was permissive for non-A, non-B hepatitis, and, you know, then called hepatitis C, was our closest relative, the chimpanzee. There was no cell culture system that was sort of robust. And if you wanted to study HCV, you had to do studies in chimpanzees. And, you know, you really can't do mechanistic science in an animal model like that. I mean, you can understand certain things about, you know, sort of replication of the virus and, you know, sort of whether or not it can become chronic or whether or not it gets resolved, and, you know, sort of the association with inflammation and liver damage and so on. But, you know, it's the chimpanzee model is very difficult. And of course, we don't even do interventional science in chimpanzees anymore, and haven't for, I guess, around 10 years now. So anyway, very, very, very tough. And so, you know, if you really want to set up a genetic system to study this virus along the lines that I told you that we had for yellow fever and had done for syndesmosis as well, then how are you going to test it? You know, there was no validated cell culture system. And so the only way to test it was actually to take our synthetic, you know, sort of lab design and made genome RNA for hepatitis C and inject it into the liver of a chimpanzee and see if it launched virus infection and caused disease. And so luckily, we were able to sort of take on that, you know, sort of course of action with Steve Feinstein's help, because he had access to, you know, the chimpanzee model. And so we tried this sort of using the approaches that we had been successful using for these other viruses, making a cDNA copy, making gobs of RNA and injecting it. And we failed miserably. You know, there was no evidence of any virus replication going on at all. And This happened through a couple tries over a span of years. And finally, we began to wonder if, sort of the cDNA clone that we'd made of the virus that we were using to make this RNA, maybe if it, maybe it wasn't right. It only takes, sort of one mutation in the wrong place, and you go from something that can replicate to something that's dead as a doornail. And so the first thing we looked at was the end of the genome. And because there had been people reporting that the 3' end of the viral genome RNA sort of ended differently. The prototype one ended with the same kind of homopolymer track that cellular messenger RNAs end with, poly A. But then there was some Japanese work that sort of suggested that the genome ended in poly U. And we knew from yellow fever that the genome didn't end in either one of those homopolymer tracks, but instead had sort of an RNA structure that had a stem and loops, and and so we began to wonder, was the 3' end really right or not? And Sasha Kolokolov, a really fantastic sort of molecular biologist, had joined the lab, had immigrated from Russia actually, and sort of took on that challenge and discovered that there was a sequence of about 100 bases that was missing from the 3' end of the viral genome. And so we thought, and it was very highly conserved. Hepatitis C is a quite a variable virus, and there are a number of genotypes that are, quite different from each other. And this sequence of about 100 bases was present and almost invariant. So it wasn't something that obviously, you would think the virus could do without. These things have these very compact genomes. They can't encode much. They have to be, sort of very good at what they do. So anyway, we made a variant then that, so it had this new sequence on it and tried it out in chimps, and it didn't work again. And so that was really disappointing. We're talking about, 1995, 1996. So we began to wonder, well, maybe, because reverse transcriptase makes mistakes, and we knew that the viral population that we were working with was already, heterogeneous, and there were variants. It wasn't like all the genome RNAs in that population were the same. And so, maybe there were other mistakes or other missing things in the sequence that we were using. And so we really sort of tackled that and then assembled a sequence which reflected basically the average sequence of the population. At every nucleotide in the genome, if you sequence several different clones and you see variation, but say two out of three are a particular, subnucleotide, we'd say, okay, well, that one must be, sort of not a potential lethal variant, but it must be right. And so we did that, and it worked. And that was something that we published in 1997. Sometimes I get my decades and centuries mixed up here.
Yeah,
And
centuries.
so we finally had what we knew was a functional clone.
What is the role of interferons in the host immune response to both HCV and other viruses?
Well, it's an amazing defense system that we have, that vertebrates have, and higher animals have. And it's basically nature's, sort of broad spectrum antiviral, defense machine. It's a secreted protein that's made by cells when they sort of notice that something is going on. So when a virus infects a cell, the cell has a number of pathways that are designed to sort of sense that a foreign invader has shown up. And for example, in the case of these RNA viruses, sort of in order to amplify their genome RNAs, they go through a complementary negative strand intermediate, which can give rise to a double-stranded sort of RNA product or intermediate. And so cells have evolved a system to sort of recognize the presence of double-stranded RNA, for example, and then basically turn on interferon through a intracellular signaling pathway. Or actually, there are also some of these receptors on the surface of cells that trigger sort of an endosomal sort of driven signaling path. And that pathway, one of the things that it can do is to produce interferon, which is a secreted protein that can, and for the type 1 interferons, almost all cell types in our body have receptors that recognize that molecule. And when interferon binds to its receptor through an intracellular signaling event, this was actually one of the signaling pathways that was first really sort of figured out. Because you can just take interferon and dump it on cells, and it turns on this very robust gene expression program. So if you want to understand how a signal from the outside actually leads to changes in transcription in the nucleus, this was a pretty cool sort of biological system to study when Jim Darnell and George Stark, you know, sort of did that in spades. But anyway, you know, sort of what the result is that interferon triggers the expression of hundreds of what we call interferon-stimulated genes. And those, we became interested in that because it turned out that the cornerstone of hepatitis C treatment, and even before it was discovered, when it was non-A, non-B hepatitis, was administration of type 1 interferon. And the treatment was, you know, sort of pretty pathetic because, I mean, we all know, you know, sort of what interferon feels like if you've had, you know, the flu or a bad cold or whatever, fever, chills, sort of nausea. So, you know, having to use this as a therapy is not the greatest, but it could eliminate HCV in a, you know, reasonable percentage of people that were treated. And so we became interested in that just to try and understand, well, if interferon can actually lead to, you know, clearance of HCV. And actually, HCV is an interesting virus because it selectively infects liver cells, which are called hepatocytes. But it's actually a virus that is, it doesn't kill the cell. It establishes sort of a chronic replication in liver cells. And it's actually the immune reaction that recognizes this sort of foreign agent that causes damage to the liver cells and the disease. So at any rate, you know, sort of interferon turns on all these genes, and what it does, and what is so amazing about this is that you can take a cell that is susceptible to infection by, you know, 20, 30, you know, different viruses, RNA viruses, DNA viruses, single-stranded RNA viruses, negative-stranded viruses, any virus that you can imagine pretty much. And if you treat a cell that's permissive for that virus with interferon before you add the virus, it's the cell's resistant to the virus. And, you know, sort of how does that happen? We just sort of became interested in that, that subject, thinking that if we could understand more about it, maybe we could mimic, you know, sort of the therapeutic effects that interferon had at eliminating hepatitis C without just dumping on tons of interferon and making people feel like, you know, crap, you know, for 6 months or a year or even longer. So, you know, it's that was how we got seduced into studying, you know, sort of interferon. It turned out that we didn't need to know any of that stuff in order to you know, sort of move towards, you know, really effective new treatments for hepatitis C. But we kind of got hooked in terms of curiosity, in terms of understanding more about, you know, sort of how this system works. And that continues to be a major focus in the lab today.
Well, this has been a kind of a wonderfully comprehensive dive into your research career. Just to shift gears a little bit, we're also wondering, what was it like the morning that you got the call that you'd been awarded the Nobel Prize in medicine or physiology? I'm sure this is not a question you're a stranger to.
No. You know, it was very strange in a sense because sort of my spouse and the dogs, we have a house in Connecticut. So they were there. She has some, you know, some respiratory issues. So we were being very careful about, you know, sort of, you know, this was at the beginning of October 2020. So, you know, we're kind of in the North American epicenter of the pandemic here in New York City. So I was, sort of in the apartment across the street, and she was at this house in Connecticut. The phone rings at like 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm sort of by myself, sort of stumbling out of the bedroom to, because this is a landline, which I never use, but for some reason we have this. And so I'm sort of fumbling around in the dark. And actually, the first time it rang, I just sort of stood there and said, this has got to just be a, an errant call. They'll just go away. So it stopped ringing. I went back to back in the bedroom, and then it started ringing again. Now I was really getting mad. And so I sort of went out there and grabbed the phone, and I guess I, it was still dark, so I guess I pushed the answer button instead of the hang up button. And there was this fellow on the phone with a Swedish accent, sort of informing me of this, which, there's no way I was expecting this to happen. And so I really didn't believe him. My first I thought maybe it was a, an ill-advised practical joke by people in the lab. So, he continued telling me that, no, that this was real. And then I, when he mentioned, sort of Harvey Alter and Michael Houghton and hepatitis C, then it sort of, started to make, maybe it sounded a little bit more real. But I still, in terms of the discovery of the virus, I mean, we discovered a little piece at the three prime end and, made a functional clone and some other things. I didn't think that that was any kind of, big deal. And so, for a while, I wasn't even sure, whether or not they got it right or not. But anyway, I guess the thing that sort of solidified it was that, so that phone call hang up. He says that I'm going to be called by somebody from the press in an hour. So I think that was like at 5 o'clock. I don't remember, 5 or 6. And also that if I still didn't believe him, I could actually sort of tune in to the actual announcement of the prize, from the Nobel folks. And that was happening like a half an hour after that. And anyway, so I was in a state of shock at that point. I called up, sort of Peggy and in Connecticut, and I think she objected to being woken up this early as well. But anyway, so she was, still stuck in Connecticut. And I think at that point I sort of took a shower and, made some coffee, and I did get the call, sort of from the guy who was handling the press. And he said, well, we like to have a photo, sort of the new laureate as soon as possible after they've heard the news. Well, there's nobody, in the apartment. And, I did have, sort of I guess an ancient version of the iPhone or something at that point. Well, that's not that long ago. And he said, well, could you just, I said, there's nobody here to take a picture of me. He says, could you just take a selfie? I barely knew what a selfie was, and I'd never taken one before. So I was trying to, sort of take these selfie directions from this guy in Sweden and sort of figure out how to do this. I think I ended up taking, sort of pictures of wall hangings and other things in the apartment before I actually sort of got my face. Anyway, and then after that, it was quite a day. But it was interesting because, this was sort of in the middle of the pandemic. And so sort of a lot of the sort of celebratory aspects of this were, done via Zoom. I didn't have to sort of go and talk in front of large crowds of people. Interviews were conducted by Zoom. I didn't have to get fully dressed up. Only the top half really mattered. It was much different, I guess, than the usual sort of experience, but certainly a very unique one.
And since then, in the last 3.5 years, how has winning the prize, what are the biggest ways that it's changed your life and your research?
Well, it's made it harder to do research, because you get asked to do all this other stuff. You guys wouldn't be talking to me right now if I hadn't been awarded this prize. I think in some respects, probably it's better if you get this after you're retired, because then you actually have time to sort of, sort of do more of these things. But I'm still re really very interested in what's happening in the lab here. So it's actually kind of, I had, maybe two full-time jobs before this happened, and now I've got, sort of four of them, because you do get asked to do a lot of things, and obviously you have to learn to say no. But then there are things that are important, and after I think you've been in the field for a while, there are a contingent of friends and colleagues that it's difficult to say no to, and so it's been quite an experience. It's actually been fun to, sort of get to know some of the other laureates. There are a lot of activities that we participate in that have to do with sort of human rights issues and, science issues and all those kinds of things that where, maybe by tackling some of these challenges as a group, we can have some small impact on sort of moving things forward. I think this is a very, very important sort of area for your generation as well, because obviously you've got a lot of issues to sort of work on and problems to solve that we need to get going on.
Do you have any other passions? What do you like to do in your spare time? I know you mentioned being in nature.
Yeah, no, I like, hiking and backpacking. Obviously, sort of living in the heart of, sort of Manhattan doesn't necessarily lend itself to those kinds of activities. So we often in the late summer, early fall, head off to a very remote spot in Wyoming. For me, the Sierras and sort of Kings Canyon and Sequoia got too crowded. We've sort of spent more time in sort of Wyoming lately, and very much enjoy that. I'd say there's maybe a little less backpacking and a little more sort of sitting around, reading books and watching the weather change. The dogs obviously love that. We have three Australian Shepherds right now, and so if we go to Wyoming, we have to drive. So that's a 2,000-mile commute. I guess some of the other things. Well, I like being outdoors. I like playing frisbee with the dogs, and they like that. I can't even sort of utter that word in their presence without them sort of getting riled up. I guess one of the other things that I got interested at UC Davis was viticulture and enology, so sort of wine making and wine tasting. And so that's kind of a hobby that I have sort of pursued over the last several decades. But most of all, I just kind of like bumping around the lab and trying to create an environment where some of these future young superstars can have some freedom to do cool science and put themselves in a good position to move on to the next step in their careers.
And lastly, what advice do you have for young scientists and college students going forward in their careers?
Well, I think it's important to find something that really turns you on, something that you have a real, passion for, and then really sort of going for it. I mean, I think any career path, if you really want to sort of succeed at a high level, takes a lot of work and sort of dedication to do that. And it certainly helps to get past the bumps in the road if you really are, passionate about, sort of a particular, sort of problem where we have a knowledge gap. And I think there's always too sort of a balance between doing things that are, sort of more translational, that could be applied to human health versus just curiosity-driven research. And I think we have to really sort of find a balance there, because if you look at the great discoveries that have been made, it's that have, sort of changed biomedicine. Most of them come from basic science. So CRISPR, for example, that's something that if you said, okay, NIH should fund a whole bunch of stuff, trying to figure out, sort of what this bacterial immune system is, sort of up to, it probably would have, been, sort of thumbs down. But if you look at the recombinant DNA sort of revolution, sort of the the sequencing revolution, the sort of CRISPR revolution that we're in now. Those all came from, people just, trying to understand cool biology. So I would say passion and hard work, if you want to succeed.
Well, Dr. Rice, thank you so much. That's all we have for you today. But again, what an honor to have you on.
Well, it was a pleasure to meet both of you, and I wish you both sort of the best on this, the career path that you are on. And I hope we run into each other again. We do have some good medical schools and other tri-institutional programs here in New York City. And it's a little bit different than St. Louis, I have to admit, but still an interesting place to live.
We would like to thank Dr. Rice for giving us his time. He was extremely generous and kind. Despite him being the guest, he was eager to ask us questions about our medical school applications.
Dr. Rice also demonstrated how great scientists know where in history their work fits into the larger picture. The series of discoveries about hepatitis C virus, of which Dr. Rice played a big part, all work together to save countless lives and change the way we study viruses.
If you like the Masterminds podcast, you can support us by following us on Spotify or subscribing on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn at Masterminds Pod. Please leave comments on any of our latest posts if there are any topics or guests you would like to include on future episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Masterminds.